Right, thank you very much, Glenn, for a very interesting sort of sobering talk as well. So there's plenty there to chew over. What I'd suggest, and I'm happy to go with the majority, maybe if we have a discussion, it's about 9:30, does that sound about right, and then retire to the bar? Everyone okay with that? Speak now or forever, hold your peace? Yeah, right, okay. So any initial thoughts, questions? Bill, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, I think just on the point you said about when people just don't get it, the solution seems obvious to us and not to them. And of course, you know, the argument that certainly the American right see it this way, that they see the environmental agenda as just a straight-up communist agenda, and they're against it in that way. And I saw a very interesting blog. I can't remember the exact details of what was in it, but it shook me, because, you know, we say that there's only one way to solve the ecological crisis, and that's socialism. But there is another viable strategy, which is mass genocide. And if you are among the most privileged elites in the world, and you think you're securely going to be able to survive a human dieback, then that is a viable way to go. So the point is this: we can start to see an emergence of a reason why, you know, top levels like Donald Trump just won't even accept that there's a problem, because for him, he'll always have an army or a guard that will be able to provide it. And also, unlike, say, the 19th century, when the ultra-rich lived in the same cities as the working class, therefore had to have sanitation and solve the environmental problems of the cities, there will always be a patch of the earth that Donald Trump will be able to escape to when the rest of us are like that polar bear standing on the last ice floor. So it's not a question of human survival. I think it's a deeply political thing as well that we have to be aware of. Not see it simply as, oh, this is a technical fix to an obvious problem, but a social question that we have to answer as a class rather than as
There was a ripple of laughter when you said that, but I mean, but the disturbing thing is, actually, it's not that far-fetched if you think about it, is it? Because on a smaller scale, you know, the army are called in to tear gas or shoot people that are unruly. So it's a very good point. It'd be interesting to see what other people thought of that. But I don't think it's fantasy land at all.
Any other points or questions? Does everyone want to head to the land that quickly? Oh, Howard, yeah.
Glenn, you were talking of one point about the way in which people in authority or in power sort of know what the problems are, but they only go so far. They won't change things, I think is the way you put it. And you attributed this possibly to a lack of moral compass on their part. I think there are sort of two sides to this. First of all, it's probably true that people who are, people who are at the top of companies or have got influential positions in the government or who run sort of big public sector organisations like universities, for example, and who therefore you think could change things but don't, do they lack moral compass? They probably do, actually, because if they didn't lack moral compass, they probably wouldn't be there in the first place. That's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd say is that even if they didn't lack moral compass, even if they would like to change things for the better, because even if the problems were pointed out to them, it's to do with profit, etc., etc., there's nothing they can do. There's absolutely nothing they can do, because the system they run is one that militates against them doing anything that goes against the dictates of profit. For example, when the Conservative government was elected under David Cameron, the last one, what they did was change a lot of rules and regulations regarding employment law. It meant a lot of people who before, if they were sort of sacked unfairly, could go to an employment tribunal, were no longer able to, because, you know, various rules were changed, which made it a lot more difficult. And it meant that a lot of people were poorer because they didn't have jobs or resources when they would have done. A lot of people's families went hungry, etc., etc., etc. Now, the people who put these regulations forward knew what the effect would be, but they nevertheless did it. Now, you know, and if you put it to them, this is what was going to happen, they could do one of two things. They could either say, well, it's something we've got to do because the system demands it, or they could say, well, look, the trouble is that we don't want to harm people, but we've no choice because as things stand, companies are finding it difficult to survive. It means that you know, people can go to employment tribunals very easily, and companies go under, etc., etc., and therefore profits are affected. So in the final analysis, in the profit system, people who are in positions of power or authority and so on, they may lack a moral compass, but whether they do or not, they've got no choice. They've got to behave in a certain way because the system forces them to do that. Only in a different kind of society would that be different. Would people be who were not who were in authority, but people who had expertise, would be in a position to say, we'll do it this way rather than that way because this is what will benefit people, not what will create profit or which will benefit some but not others.
I agree with that. I think the second thing is the most likely scenario, but that then, the trouble is that then throws up the really big question. And that kind of refers back to what you were saying, and that it has to then come from, you know, the people who are being manipulated, if you like, making the changes. So therefore, you've got this, you know, this ongoing problem of how do you begin to sort of, should you possibly, but I think you should ideally, but how do you share these thought processes? How do you share this, what is your perception of not only what the fault is, because sometimes you find people will agree, but they won't even step beyond that. They say, well, people wouldn't do that. And what people often do is talk in a way that if there was socialism, people would still behave in that society as if it was capitalism. Do you know what I mean? Have you come across that when you talk to people? So they say, oh, well, people go and take loads of stuff. And they don't kind of make the step away where you wouldn't need to. And that's a simple example, but they use all sorts of examples. So I think the big problem, if you like, and I don't have to say this to people, is why is this party so small? Why is it? What is it that needs to happen to disseminate these, share these ideas in a way that will make a change? And I think that is, I don't feel qualified even to begin to go there. I think that could be something that people with much more knowledge of social change and how communities work together, how people work together to change. And that's also why I said capitalism is so bloody good at sustaining itself, which is what you're saying, really. But I think other people here are probably far more qualified to give an answer than I am on that.
Anyone else? Yeah, Kevin?
People, look, bear with me, because I'm going to try and think on my feet, so to speak. Great information you've put out there. Really good. I was just thinking, is anyone in the audience Star Trek fans? Ever since I've been watching Star Trek, I mean, the first thing that I noticed, there was no money. They didn't have any money, did they? The place is the place all over the universe. No money was exchanged. Right? And this Roddenberry guy, he did something very clever then. That was like a little bedrock of there are possibilities. Okay, so it's gone on, and there's been Voyager, Deep Space Nine, and it was Deep Space Nine when I came across the Ferengi. Yeah, you know, people know about the Ferengi?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, everyone else don't seem to be bothered about this profit business, but the Ferengi, after they've gone plated Latin, and they would do anything for profit. So I think, can we even use some of this news at Ferengi? Do a pilot study. Go to the Ferengi, have a chat with them, find out what it is about profit, try and dissuade them from profit, and if we can get a Ferengi to change, we can get everyone else to change.
I haven't watched Star Trek ever.
Oh, well, yeah. Doctor Who's far better.
There's a woman now in Doctor Who.
There was a clip where they showed that they'd gone beyond, they explained that they'd gone beyond money, and you know, yeah, that was so classic. And one enriched oneself. But,
yeah, Mark?
Yeah, I just got a question, Glenn, and that was actually a couple of weeks ago on TV, a writer was being interviewed. It was on BBC, I think it was Interview with a Writer or something like that. I think it's a regular program. And the interviewer said, "You basically have given up on the human race," or some comment like that. It was an Indian writer I can't remember if it was a novel.
Not Amitav Ghosh, was it?
Perhaps.
He's written the book. Might have been him.
I can't remember.
Okay.
But he in answer said, yeah, he believes that we've gone too far and the changes to the environment are irreversible. And basically, it's game over. And I think also there's some other scientists or visionaries.
The guy in the chat also said something rather similar. I've forgotten his name.
Starting to talk in that way.
Yeah.
James
Lovelock. He says.
Right.
Sorry to interrupt.
Well, no. Well, so you mentioned 2050 as a number that's coming up at the tipping point. So as I, while I'm coming here, I thought I really do want to put the question. I was actually thinking of putting it to you, so I'll take the chance now. Of generally as socialists, we proclaim ourselves to be optimists because we're generally optimists about human beings and human potential. And so it's a horrible way to think that perhaps some of these changes, or we've come to a stage where we can actually do nothing. So what would your comments and feelings be? You mentioned 2050, so that's why I allow myself to ask.
Yeah.
Do you think that we have reached, or we will soon reach?
Well, to be honest, I'm really not qualified in those areas. But all I can tell you is what I've read when I had given other talks. And I think all of you, if you just typed in 2050, you'd find a lot of disciplines would start to be papers written where that year is cited as being a point of no return. And one might think, it's almost like the man with the sandwich board walking around saying we're all doomed in a way. But the reality is, if you actually think what's happened in the last 150 years, it's in the trajectory. And you start to actually picture that and sort of open out that vision of what's happened. It seems quite plausible that an awful lot of things could happen in a way that I don't think humanity is going to end. But forgive me, I can't remember your first name.
Mark.
No, the chap in front.
Oh, sorry.
Ben.
Bill,
that's right. Sorry, Bill. Bill. Yeah. But no, coming back to what Bill was saying, there is this sort of worrying sort of undercurrent and things. I'm not a sort of conspiracist sort of type of person, but you do wonder what information is available to governments and that we are just never will be privy to and don't know. But I'm not really answering your question totally well, but I think what coming back to what I was trying to also say is that beauty can't be valued, and the environment itself gives a beauty and a feeling of well-being to people that you can't, it isn't valued, and it can't be sold in capitalism. So it's always put behind in a way. It's not valued at all. But I don't know, really. I don't know where it's going to go. I'm possibly quite glad I don't, to be honest with you. But you're right, it's an awful feeling if you think you can't do anything. But, I suppose we all work around our own thoughts and we do and say what we believe in. And I suppose that's a good thing to do, to keep doing that. And what else can one do, I suppose, would be an answer. I don't know. Sorry, that's a pretty sort of long-winded way of not terribly answering your question terribly well, really. I don't think I know. It's a simple answer.
Any other points?
I think socialism will come in before the puffins die out. Because if we're not going to have socialism before the puffins die out, I think we probably should, with the inside information, take on Mitsubishi's idea that we all go and freeze puffins. Mm. And if it don't come in, we'll become millionaires anyway.
Well, that's a thought.
So it'd be interesting to hear if anyone's got any positive solutions to say if socialism came in, or even what we could do now to some of these problems of plastic, the fish shortages and all that kind of thing. What could we do? I'd be interested to hear
from everyone, I think, don't you?
Yeah.
There's a bit of good news. I mean, I'm still optimistic that we can change things. We've got reintroduction of wolves in certain areas. I've just read that cod's back on the menu, that the cod stocks are now sustainable. So I think there is concern in certain areas. I know it's small, but I think when we've realised, if we realise in time, all of us, we can change things, we can do things, we can reintroduce species and hopefully save it before it's too late.
One would like to think so. I'm really hot and cold. There are times when I feel utterly optimistic about human beings, when you see the wonderful things that human beings can do and all the wonderful things. Then there are times when I do feel the opposite. I have to say, and you think, oh, crikey, it's going to take something really dreadful to make people even begin to think differently. And I do find that disappointing at times. But what I would say is, I think, you know, I think socialism sometimes is called utopianism, and given that, but so what? You know, utopia is good. I mean, why do we have a problem with that? You know, why do people kind of say, oh, it's going to be utopia? But yes, well, that's not bad, is it? I don't get that. But so I think one has, I say one has to, that's a really annoying phrase, but you know, it is good to have an optimism, and I think one does have to believe in people, because at the end of the day, we see time and time again, you know, whether it's Grenfell Town, those men rushing in to save people's lives. I think humans are inherently good. And another thing to think of is, it's not people that are wrong, it's a system that are conditioning them. That's the real issue. Well, thank you for listening, anyway. I think everyone's keen to get to their social, I suspect.
Any other points anyone wants to make?
Hi.
Yes. Being positive about, yes, I think is think about stop consumerism, you know, we just try to the discharge of things or the abundance of accumulation of wealth and power. That's the problem we're living today. And then how if you people get to understanding that you have to have enough for you, but enough for everyone else as well, and then that's the way forward. And of course, fishing stocks, veganism, and things like that has been a really kind of positive solution towards the destruction of many species of animals and things like that. It's just one to add to that.
Thank you.
Okay, any other points? Right?
I was just wondering about all species. I mean, you showed the picture of the blue butterfly, which was very beautiful, but I'm a bit more doubtful about slugs and...
oh, they'd be all right.
And jellyfish.
And eels as well.
You're absolutely right. Not all species. And okay, if you read the Nature periodicals, they do, some are increasing, because by dint of the fact that it, as the climate changes, it suits some species more, but the overall trajectory is not terribly good with species, and it hasn't been for a long time. As I said, this is our reality, what we're experiencing now, and I think that none of us here would remember, you know, the vast numbers of animals that once did live, of course, and that's why I mentioned Paleolithic people, because they would have looked out on different species altogether. The oryx and massive, huge, different animals we don't have now, but that's not a reason to think that. You know, when you Bill mentioned population, and you know, that is often the elephant in the room with a lot of people as well. And the population is expanding very rapidly, and the expectations of that population are expanding, which comes back to what the lady at the back was saying, of course. And you're encouraged to expect lots of material wealth, and this is part and parcel. And of course, the system doesn't function unless it can sell you lots of things you don't really need. And there was some research done that suggested that. Since I think it was about 1960, the general happiness of people, if you like, or the happiness quotient, was rising along with the sort of, if you like, the wealth. In other words, people getting washing machines, and they were getting heating, and the water was clean, and so on and so forth. And then about 1960, the happiness dropped off, the material wealth kept on going up. And so that was an interesting statistic. And another one I've never really found out the source of it, but I read that if you take employed people in the world, something like 60% of employed people are entirely employed around finance matters. So they might be accountants or bankers or checkout assistants or dealing with finance in one form or another. So that alone is an argument for socialism, isn't it? Because socialism will 60% of the time will suddenly be freed up, you know, which is another good thing to think about. There's lots of good things to think about. And, you know, I come back to what I said earlier, the environment is utterly beautiful and it's there for us. And these are all things that we were talking about, the optimistic side we need to have, I think, is to share a passion and love for people and society and the environment, and that stuff feeds into people. I think they take that on board. What they don't tend to take on board quite so much is the heavy duty politics side of it, because they will frankly often think of Russia or communism or whatever they want to think of. So
can I ask a question, Graham?
Yeah.
You mentioned the goldfinches. This might sound a bit banal, but why have they disappeared? I used to have thousands in my garden, and they've gone completely.
But
I've got loads of tits.
Yeah, they've always been pretty good, but it's agricultural practice. You know, it's what happens is things like it's to get more profit out of the field instead of leaving the stubble in for a great deal longer. And used to have all the birds came down and fed on the stubble, and some like the. Well, there's one, I'll remember it in a minute. It might, the woodcock may be one, but there's another one that's almost completely gone. I'll think of it in a minute. It used to nest in the stubble and it all tied in. Now they, the moment the crop's off, they're ploughing it up and getting another one in because it's more money.
Yeah.
It always comes down to the same thing, I'm afraid. I can't remember the name of that bird. It bugs me now. It's only on Orkney now, I think. But anyway.
Corn grey.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. Yeah,
so it's purely what they eat then?
Yeah.
It's purely what they eat.
It's a method of farming. It's farm habitat loss and farming are real big things in terms of wildlife diminution.
Janet had her hand up, then Lois, and then Brian. Janet.
Thank you. Yeah, I found myself thinking about species loss and how we very often focus on the human species. What will happen, you know, are we going to survive? That comes through an awful lot, doesn't it? We talk about all the, you know, mammals, birds, fish, whatever. But thinking about the humankind. And that's also very possibly on the cards, the way it's described now. I don't think there's any doubt about that. That would be a matter of time and whether things would change quickly enough or not. Mm. But I also find myself sort of thinking, well, really would that be too great a loss? Because the planet wouldn't disappear.
Yeah.
The planet would still be there. There would be something still living, I don't doubt, whether it's the cockroach or, you know, something that I can't even imagine. That would continue. Now, that might be sort of sad for us to think of sitting here. But then when we think of the time scale for when this thing might happen anyway, would any of us be around here to actually observe that, to see that really coming to that event? It would be interesting to be able to know if that would be. Okay, we wouldn't have reached socialism, if you see what I'm saying. But I just wonder, do we really have to consider it a total loss?
Well, I have two thoughts on what you just said. One is I spoke to a friend who's far more educated in social interplay than I am. And he said, I've talked to him about something very similar. And he said that part of the problem is that people find it almost impossible to think with care about one generation either side of themselves. Mm-hmm. They can't seem to think beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore that goes into the future. And I think you think about your grandchildren, but then how much do you think, you know, you kind of think they're going to get on with it maybe. But also the point of, again, another coming back from what you've just said and coming back to what I was trying to get over was that, yes, you could sort of sit back and think, well, maybe things will go that way. And of course you're right, the planet, as it were, will carry on. But isn't it just a terrible shame that what is actually a very, very beautiful world and place to live wouldn't be available to some people? That's what really upsets me.
Yes.
And there's a writer, I discussed with a lady who's here, who comes from Kettering, and there's a writer who's had the strange pseudonym of BB. Some of you may have read or heard of him. He lived near Kettering, I think, in Northamptonshire. I think it was over that way. And he wrote at the sort of pretty much the turn of the century up until 1970 when he died. He was one of the later natural history writers, really. But he constantly said, gosh, you know, it's so beautiful, this world, and every day is important to me. And, you know, as he got older, this feeling became more and more acute. And I'm finding that, you know, when you're young, you kind of get on with stuff, and there might be your butterfly, you don't really care. But now that stuff becomes immensely valuable, and you think, crikey. And because you feel like that, you kind of want that experience to be available to future generations. And that's kind of what drives me in the way I think. So, I mean, I think socialism needs to be communicated to all sorts of sources, and most of you here are probably far better equipped to communicate it, perhaps politically and from other viewpoints than I am. But, I mean, I think it needs to make people want it and be enthused about the happiness and beauty that could come from it. I think sometimes in the political terms that kind of gets lost a bit, you know, and you know what we are aiming for is something quite amazing and something quite beautiful, and I think that's the key thing to try and get over.
Lois?
Yeah, I think it's quite a few different points. I think I agree with you 100% on that, and I think that we have a younger generation in this country that have all done the environment as part of their education. And it's quite interesting when you see them coming through university because they don't want to go into the corporates. So we've got a whole mixture. We've got ecosystems across the world that have been destroyed. We've got corporates who actually are supposed to, in their returns, put in what they're doing about the environment. They have to tick the box. It's a legal requirement. And I think the thing is that the word socialism doesn't ring with all those issues. Mm. I mean, for me personally, I'm a geographer, but I've studied ecosystems, you know, since I was like a teenager. And I've worked in corporates, and I was on a train, just very briefly. These guys, I know who they work for because I listened, but all they were doing were looking at their flow charts, their profit margins. I just sat there, I thought, I'm going to watch what you're doing and what you're thinking. And their headspace was about nothing but keeping their job and getting those profit margins. So to alter that, which is what everybody in this room wants to do, I think it has to be bottom-up. It's something I believe in. I think bottom-up is the way to change stuff. Mm. But I also think that you mentioned frugalism. I think recycling, the remakery movement, they're all alive and well. And that's the positive side. I personally do not want to buy stuff from the shops. I want to recycle my money through charity shops or through remaking things. You know, the remaker is growing up with kids wanting to do stuff. You know, I think that is a way the environment can go forward. In order to change the corporates, I think that their brains are, you know, they are forced into doing this profit margin the whole time. Mm. And that's where we have to break that somehow and not buy their bloody stuff. Mm. Don't buy it.
There's this case, but although I don't want to be too contradictory, I think, you know, as I said, the great capitalism success story is its ability. We wouldn't need to recycle stuff because it wouldn't be made in the first place in socialism.
But you know, you would because you'd reuse things. And I mean, you know, the longevity thing, when things now marketing, it's you know, planned obsolescence. We know what Marshall McLuhan said. You know, planned obsolescence. You know, we know about that. We still are forced to buy a washing machine. So why haven't we got a washing machine? Why don't we have something more, you know, more environmentally friendly thing? So, you know, I think there is possibility. And I think young people are really clear that they particularly don't want to.
I agree with your thoughts on that. But I think the sorts of things you're citing would be things that, in my view, would happen as... they'd be intrinsic within socialism. So, you know, you wouldn't... A lot of those problems would evaporate immediately. But any simple example is... I expect if you go to most households, they've got a power drill and various bits, tools and equipment that they may use once a month. If that... Those sorts of things, there's no reason they couldn't be... You wouldn't have to own it. No. It could be a pool thing. That's the thing.
Well, people are beginning to do that, which is great.
But these things happen with well-intended groups within capitalism, but... In socialism, that would be the way it was. No one would think, you would think old if you wanted your own one, basically.
We have to make the joining.
Yes, and that is the problem, isn't it? That's it.
Unless we do have a mass sort of killing
Brian?
I just got your personal reflections on the decline of wildlife. I'll stand up. I was born not far from here at West Brom, at West Bromwich, Friar Park, and... When I was a kid, I worked in a foundry when I was 15, and at the same time, I was very keen on birds. You know, so during the week I was working in the foundry, and a Tacles foundry, and then in my spare time I was a real keen bird watcher. But what was the and this is right in the middle of West Brom, which was right in the middle of the, you know, it was extremely industrial when I was a kid. You know, even the bottom of Spon Lane, there was a factory where my uncle worked. You know, but even then there was so much bird life around. On Farley's Knob, there were, you know, I used to go up to the cinema sometime, and there'd be about 8 or 9 pairs of skylarks in the sky. I used to go over West Friar Park sewage farm, which my mother hated me going over the sewage farm, but the sewage farm was alive with birds, and there were lapwings and all sorts of things. You know, and so it was even in West Brom. Yeah. Right in the middle of the industrial Midlands, there were plenty of lot of bird life. But what is interesting to me when you mention people like Richard Jefferies, for instance, which I've always, like Dave there, I've always been keen on Richard Jefferies, as it were. In his 30s, I mean, he died young, Richard Jefferies. He was a sort of Wiltshire naturalist. And he went to live at Surbiton in the 1880s, which in those days was on the edge of London, and it was still quite rural. And it's interesting when you read his stuff on, and there's a book called Nature Near London, which has actually been republished. And you read Nature Near London, which is Surbiton, which is now completely urbanised now, but it was a bit of the countryside in those days. When you read, there were absolutely hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of bird life around there. And in fact, at the time, there used to be lots of blokes coming from London, and they were called moochers. And they used to come around places like Surbiton to trap birds, to take them into Covent Garden, because people in London, working class people in London, used to eat birds, you know, like skylarks and finches, or they used to have cage birds. And when you read Jefferies, you realise the abundance of bird life that used to be in, this is in the 1880s, which is not that long ago. Just, you know, what you were saying about remembrance. You know, and everything's relative, really. It's, you know, you don't miss things until they've gone, actually. And you feel a bit sad now that people don't realise, you know, what the potential there is. And it's, as you say, it's all because of industrial farming, you know.
Yeah.
Well, which is capitalist farming, of course, you know.
I suppose the question that throws open again is, what some people might say, well, does it matter? I think it does, and I think come back to the point that I think, you know, this is all part of beauty. Now, okay, it may have greatly diminished since you know, the time of Gilbert White and Hudson and Jefferies and all the rest of them, but do we want it to go completely? I mean, that is the real concern, I think. I have to go, so thank you very much.
Thanks a lot again to everyone for the discussion, also to Glenn for a very interesting discussion.